Okay. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I apologize to Howie that I couldn't be here for the whole thing. But unfortunately, I had some serious business in Japan last week, which we'll get to in a little while. There are two things that I'd like to say before I actually begin the talk. The first one is I'd just like to tell all of you who haven't found this out yet that this appeared in the email this morning. Fabiola was named, as you see, person number 5 on the list of the Times People of the Year. And also the Higgs boson was named the Particle of the Year. I am actually waiting for the end of the year issue of Science Magazine, when I'm hoping that the Higgs boson will be named the Molecule of the Year. This happened previously, the cosmological constant. The science initiated something called the Molecule of the Year. And the second year, that title was won by the cosmological constant. So it's time for physics again. Okay, the second thing I'd like to say, I just need to say this to be absolutely clear about what's going on. I'm wearing a lot of hats this year, and one of them is one of the organizers of the Energy Frontier activities for SNOMASS. And another hat that I'm wearing is that I'm the head of the physics panel associated with the ILC Physics and Detector Organization. And so I just want to make absolutely clear that this has nothing to do with SNOMASS. Actually, for SNOMASS, we've delegated all of the question of what the community input on the Higgs is to a panel of people that includes Heather. So this is her responsibility. And right now, I'm just talking as a member of the ILC organization. Okay, so let's get to the subject now. So I'm going to tell you about 4 things. First of all, I'd like to discuss what does an ultimate program of measurements on the Higgs boson look like? Secondly, what does the ILC actually promise for Higgs measurements? Third, what is the status of the ILC? I'll be somewhat brief about that, but there'll be some interesting points. And finally, will Japan host the ILC? So I'm going to give you as complete as possible answers to all of these questions in this talk. Number one is there for a reason, and that is you guys have been here for a week and a half having all kinds of fun talking about the interpretation of Higgs boson measurements, and especially the possibility that some of the LHC data that we're seeing now is evidence for physics beyond the standard model. And so in this talk, we're really going to change gears, and I'd like to make a point of that before I start getting into the meat of the talk. So at the moment, we've not observed the full spectrum of Higgs decay modes. We've only observed unambiguously, really, the gamma-gamma, the ZZ, and the WW. The data's still early, there are lots of fluctuations. It's fun as theorists to try to interpret them. However, when you think about new facilities, and especially facilities that are only going to be available in the 2020s, I think you really have to take a different point of view. By the time that these experiments I'll describe will be done, the LHC will already have given us a rather complete suite of measurements on the Higgs boson. But still, I think there'll be much to learn. And I think when you go to that question, what facilities will we need in the 2020s, you have to ask, what does the ultimate Higgs program look like? What is the complete set of things that we need to learn? And can a new facility actually supply those? And so I'm going to go on about this for a little while because there are some things to say. So first of all, in this talk, I'm going to just assume that that new particle somewhere around 125 GeV, I guess in view of the talks this morning, I have to say, I'm going to assume it's only one particle. And I'm going to assume that it is a Higgs boson. That is the particle of a scalar field whose expectation value breaks SU2 cross U1. If these assumptions are not true, then E plus E minus experimentation gets a lot more interesting because we know that these particles couple with something like the standard model strength, to WW and ZZ, which means that this particle will be found in the reactions I'll talk about for E plus E minus production of the Higgs boson. And in addition, the Higgs has to be there. There has to be a Higgs. It has to be light according to the precision electroweak fits, and it also has to be there. So the whole story would be much more interesting. So I'm going to take the very conservative viewpoint that there's only one such particle, that that it is a Higgs boson. But on the other hand, if the new boson is a Higgs boson with couplings close to the standard model value, then we can make precise projections. And so this is a pretty conservative point of view, but please excuse me, that's the point of view that I'm going to take in this lecture. So having said this, I've got to emphasize that the exploration of Higgs boson physics is conceptually totally different from the thing that we're used to at LEP and SLC, quote, testing the standard model. The Higgs boson is a part of the standard model, but I think it's too naive to say that we're close to knowing all of its properties. The standard model has two pieces, which back in 1981, Lev Okun represented by this very interesting figure, D and M. D is represented by the gauge couplings. The gauge couplings refer to the SU2-3 cross SU2 cross U1 symmetry. Once you assume the symmetry and the quantum numbers, you know everything there is to know about those couplings. The only deviations can come from non-renormalizable operators and radiative corrections, so their size is very limited. Hence, the program on Higgs boson at LEP and SLC was a precision program, because that's actually as big as the effects could possibly be. For the Higgs, it's totally different. There's a sector, which Okun called M, which is responsible for symmetry breaking and mass generation. We know a finite number of bits of information about that sector. And I guess in the past half a year, we've learned about, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 more bits of information. The rest of it is a complete mystery. And I think we shouldn't be too arrogant to think that we really understand what's going on in that sector. There's a lot that could happen, a lot that we can explore. You folks have been talking about that for the past week and a half. In 1981, Lev Okun called this sector problem number one for high energy physics. I think that's still true. I won't dwell on this, but there are two ways to explore that sector. The first is to discover new particles that extend the standard model. But unfortunately, we haven't been lucky about that at LHC. So that discovery apparently must wait for the next energy stage. The second thing is we can study this new particle that we've discovered and try and learn everything we can about it, in general, in the broadest kind of interpretation of the results. One thing I'd like to emphasize is the standard model predicts that the Higgs boson couplings to each species are exactly proportional to the mass of that species. And it seems to me one of the very top issues in experimental high energy physics to figure out how to test this prediction until it breaks. And so that'll be the main emphasis of now what I'll start discussing. Okay. Now, we theorists know that we can invent a model that tweaks any individual Higgs coupling independently of the others. And so that means that if we're talking about how to learn the whole picture about the Higgs boson, we need a program that can diagnose any pattern of deviations in Higgs boson couplings. So this is the meaning and actually the importance of what I'm several times in this talk going to call model-independent measurements. How close can we come to a pattern of measurements that can diagnose any pattern of deviations? The deviations might be large, and I've just argued on the previous slide that they might be order one, and of course, you guys have been talking about models like that this week. On the other hand, there's the possibility that they could be small but still extremely relevant. And that possibility comes from this thing that actually Howie was the first to enunciate called the decoupling theorem, which states that if you have the situation that frankly looks like many people's idea of what we're seeing in the LHC data, that there's a light Higgs and then the threshold for other new particles is much higher at a scale m, the light Higgs will resemble the standard model Higgs to an accuracy of order mh squared, or maybe m top squared, divided by m squared. And so on the one hand, we have the possibility of order 1 deviations. On the other hand, we have the possibility of this number, which gets you to the few percent level. And so somewhere in between, we'll find out how the Higgs, this Higgs boson, whether it is exactly standard model, whether it has clues to what's beyond the standard model, maybe it ragingly is extended beyond the standard model expectation. Somewhere in there is the truth. We don't know where, but to think about facilities for the 2020s, we have to think about all of these possibilities. Anyway, this sets a requirement for the target precision of the experiments in our future program. And there are many worked examples that point to the percent level of accuracy as being important. So here's a little catalog of effects in supersymmetry, from the fact that you have a two Higgs doublet model there, the fact that there are potentially large and very slowly decoupling radiative corrections in the Higgs BB bar coupling that Howie and Heather talked about 10 years ago. In little Higgs models, there are new particles that give loop effects of this order. In composite Higgs models, the higher dimension operators contribute effects of this order. So roughly, if you can get to the percent level, you can get to something like 3 TeV in new particle masses. And you're competitive with the direct searches of LHC for these particles in the same time frame. If you can't get to the percent level, if you're stuck, let's say, at the 10% level, you may be blind to all of these effects and will miss a whole window that we have on physics beyond the standard model. And so now how do you do that? Oh, I love to show this plot. This, you probably saw this already because Joanne or Tom must have shown it. So this is the current set of neutralino LSP models in this program that Joanne Hewitt and Tom Rizzo have of trying to make hundreds of thousands of supersymmetry models that pass all current constraints, including B-physics, dark matter, and the LHC searches, I guess as of the end of August or something like that. So here is the ratio of the Higgs BB bar coupling to the standard model value in those models. Our knowledge today is total ignorance across this diagram. Any of these models could be the correct one. Eventually, we'll have much more precise constraints. The constraint that the ILC will place is given by this little pink line that you can see here. And in principle, that could be anywhere on this diagram. But in particular, if it's very close to one, an accuracy like that is needed to make model discrimination. Okay, now to reach this level of accuracy, in a model-independent context, we need to think about what we're actually measuring. And so please excuse me for boring you, but I want to be very precise about this. The thing we want to know is the deviation in the coupling. That is a number kappa A, which is equal to G HAA bar divided by the standard model value. In addition, I claim the couplings to glu-glu, gamma-gamma, and gamma-z, which are loop-induced, should be considered as separate, additional, independent couplings. Those are, of course, generated by the couplings of the Higgs to WW and TT bar, but they could also be generated by new physics. And in little Higgs models, for example, that's the dominant effect. So if we're talking about tweaking all of the individual couplings, we can tweak these couplings independent of the ones that arise at tree level. And so we need a multi-parameter fit, which includes the possibility of all of these couplings varying independently. If we can measure a total cross-section, we can determine this coupling deviation. For example, the sigma for AA bar going to H divided by its standard model value is exactly kappa A. The ratio of branching ratios also gives us information on the kappas directly. A ratio of branching ratios, I should have said here, divided by its standard model value, is the ratio of the squares of two kappas. The interpretation of these quantities is quite unambiguous. On the other hand, these two quantities are very difficult to measure, and especially if your tool is the LHC. The LHC measures quantities like this, which I've called mu AB, the relative rates. So it's a sigma times a branching ratio. The sigma is proportional to the gamma for the entrance channel. The branching ratio is proportional to the gamma for the exit channel divided by the total width. The total width of a standard model like Higgs boson at 125 GeV is 4 MeV. And there's no collider, except maybe in the far, far future, the muon collider, that can directly measure the width of that resonance. So instead, that becomes part of your fit, part of your set of free parameters. And the thing you're sensitive to has a structure in terms of the kappas that looks like this. And in principle, some of the things in the denominator might not be visible at the LHC, either because they're truly invisible modes, for which there actually is some strategy having to do with vector boson fusion, or maybe modes that are not invisible, but just are incredibly difficult to see in a hadronic environment, like Higgs de Glugli. And so that then becomes a problem. How do you go from these things to the things that you really want to measure, which are the individual amplitudes for the Higgs to turn into some new particle? At the moment, there are no independent measurements of sigma because we don't see all the final states at the LHC. Even branching ratios are hard to measure with high accuracy because certainly in all the LHC searches that have been published so far, there's a different strategy for every final state. And so there are different acceptances, different corrections that you would make for every individual final state measurement. Okay. Sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. I've divided out. Sorry? Yes. So this is the total width divided by something, which is also divided out in the numerator. Okay. Okay. At the LHC, as everyone knows, it's not possible to extract the kappa A's in a model-independent way. There's always the possibility that there's some hard-to-observe mode that increases the Z width, and the reason that branching rates are low or high is because of this effect. There's a relatively mild theoretical assumption that resolves this issue, which is to assume that the kappa W and the kappa Z are bounded above by 1. This is roughly the statement that the various Higgs bosons in a multi-Higgs boson theory contribute additively to the W and Z masses, which is true, maybe even more generally, in models with no doubly charged Higgs and no Higgs CP violation. I guess the precise statement is in a paper by Howie Jack and Jose Woodka, but roughly this is the story. So the people who've looked at the ultimate reach of the LHC in this broad context of as model independent as possible, starting with some early 2000s papers of Dersen et al. I guess, Heather, you were a collaborator on some of that. Use this assumption to make headway. Otherwise, you can't even get started. In that context now, people are beginning to look at what looks like the current LHC capabilities, the experiment's extrapolations of those things into the future, and the theoretical errors and the various sources of error within the measurement to try and do multi-parameter global fits and figure out where we'll end up. This is a new result presented by Dirk Zervos at the LCWS 2012 meeting. So these are LHC fractional measurement errors on couplings for WZ, top, bottom, tau, gamma, and glu for, these people are very bold, 30 inverse femtobarns, 300, 1,000, and the full high luminosity LHC program. I think CMS is much more aggressive that this thing will go down like the square root of n, but these people take much more accurate account of, in particular, the theoretical errors, which are very hard to decrease. I should say that Marcus Klute is an author of this paper, this work, and also the CMS work, so I'm not sure what side of this he resides on. You've all seen, I hope many of you have seen my estimate of this. So This is one experiment times 300 inverse femtobarns. This is where various systematic errors begin to come in, and I didn't want to go beyond that. But as you see, it's those other guys are more conservative than I am. But I think we agree that on many of the important couplings, like B and GLU, we'd be very lucky to get even to the 10% level in this kind of model-independent picture of LHC. We're going to do fantastically at LHC. I think that's what these two slides show. But fantastically is not good enough. The physics demands better. And we have to go further. And to go further, we need a new facility. So let's now turn over and start talking about that. So what does ILC promise for the Higgs boson measurements? So first of all, what is ILC? Again, sorry if some of these points are quite elementary. The International Linear Collider, ILC, is an E plus E minus collider with a design center of mass energy defined to be 500 GeV. The technology allows extension in energy to 1 TeV. It also allows one to run at any center of mass energy between about 200 GeV and the top energy of the machine, with an instantaneous luminosity roughly proportional to the center of mass energy. So for definiteness, because this is what people have studied, I'm going to consider the following luminosity samples. 250 at 250, 500 at 500, and 1,000 at 1,000. That's easy to remember. The LEP3 people like 500 at 250, which they think is... This is roughly, by the way, for ILC, a three-year program at each energy. The LEP3 people consider a five-year program at a somewhat higher luminosity, which accounts for some discrepancies between the numbers people quote. This is a concise overview of the entire LHC program, to ILC program. So people also envision running at some lower energies for some precision purposes. Then we start at 250, various stages beyond that. New reactions come into play. There are also some beyond the standard model reactions, like these two that appear in the table. The ILC will have, in the design, both polarized electron and polarized positron beams. Polarization in the electron beam, of course, is extremely important because above the Z, all processes have order one polarization asymmetries. Polarization in the positron beam is also interesting because almost all the signal reactions you're interested in are helicity conserving, which means that if you can collide preferentially right-handed electrons with left-handed positrons and vice versa, you can increase your rates. And that actually will play into some of the numerical estimates that I'll give. Those of you who were very careful about the numbers will note that this effect was omitted in this joint ILC click document that was submitted to the European Strategy Study. But it's taken into account correctly here. And for each of these processes, there's a code about polarization is always important, but there's a code about why it's important. And you can ask me about that at the end if you wish. Yes. Oh, so the ILC has bunch trains. So there are five bunch trains per second with roughly 1,300 bunches in a train. And my understanding is that you can flip the polarization from train to train, but it's the same within every bunch. And the polarization actually depends on whether you measure the polarization before the bunch collision, during the collision, or afterward. But fortunately, there are calibration processes like small angle Baba scattering and WW at small angles that are sensitive to the actual polarization in the collision. So you can measure it in situ to something like 10th percent accuracy. Now, depending on what number appears in this column, you may want to run with purely left-handed polarization. Like, for example, if your main goal in the physics program is to study reactions like this one and this one, those only are generated by left-handed electrons, so you might as well just run with left-handed electrons. For others, probably for the 250 GeV Higgs program, you probably want to run half and half. Okay, here's a reminder of the Higgs cross-sections at the ILC. So once again, what I'm talking about is to run at 250, which is the peak of the Z-Higgs process, to run at 500, where you're beyond the crossover. This is Z-Higgs, this is WW fusion, this is ZZ fusion, which is much smaller. So to run at this energy, the top energy of the ILC is beyond the crossover between these processes. And then if we can run at 1 TeV, we're in the region, this thing goes up eventually logarithmically with energy, in the region where the W fusion is much enhanced and the cross-section is much higher. So we'll talk about these three programs in turn. Okay, let's start with 250 GeV. This is the peak of the E plus E minus to Z Higgs cross-section, this process that I've shown here. In the program that I've described, about 90,000 Higgs bosons are produced before you consider acceptances. The Higgs bosons are tagged by a Z at the recoil energy. If you observe the Z, and it has the energy to be recoiling against 125 GeV particle, whatever's on the other side is a decay product of the Higgs boson. To determine branching ratios, you count them. This tagging has its own benefits. It gives the Higgs mass from precision measurement of the Z to 32 MeV. It gives the total cross-section, and I mean the total cross-section because we haven't used any property of the Higgs boson, to 2.5%, so that's really what I call model independent. And it gives the invisible branching ratio. In the standard model, it would give a limit of 0.8%. And by the way, if the Higgs decays in some funny way to long-lived particles in the dark sector that go a meter and then they decay, those would be tagged as Higgs boson decays in this environment. That's what I mean by this last point. Okay. Here are some simulations of the recoil distribution in mu mu x and in E plus E minus. You have to know about the beam conditions. So you have to know what the initial state beam is. You have to understand the beam Strohlung spectrum. Again, one is going to measure that from these calibration processes that I just talked about. So there's no difficulty in terms of achieving the accuracy that I claimed. Branching ratios are measured by counting, but there's a subtlety that you have to separate the CC bar and the glue-glue decay modes. And this would be done by some kind of multivariate technique. So this is an illustration from the Asian ILD group. These are two multivariate variables called C-likeness and B-likeness. And you can see that the various classes of events pile up in an interesting way in different corners. So the B events are very B-like. The B tagging probability at the ILC is something like 90%. The C tagging probability is 60% because you have pixels in very close. And these three things on the bottom have different patterns that are very clearly distinguished. So here's a final table of numbers. You can peruse it at your leisure, of various things that you can measure and the expected relative error. I point out that this is a total cross-section measurement. And so it gives, in a model-independent way, the Higgs-ZZ coupling. Everything else, you have to infer the couplings. And there is actually one problem that one should note, which is that it's not possible, even in this environment, to measure the Higgs width directly. So you have to get the width indirectly. Now, the Higgs width can be determined in a model-independent way using this formula. The total width is equal to the Higgs to ZZ width, which we've measured by measuring the cross-section to high accuracy. On the other hand, we also need the branching ratio. The branching ratio of a standard model Higgs to ZZ, it's 2%, and you run out of statistics to get a very accurate value. So when you put everything together, the total width is limited in this method just from this alone at the 30% level. So that's a 15% error that come into all the coupling determinations. If you add LHC data and do a global fit, this goes down to around 7%. It's still not adequate. And by the way, if you run the stated LEP3 program, you also end up with about a 7% error, which they don't say this, but it has to be convolved with all the coupling errors in their tables. There is a solution to this problem, which is running at higher energy. And so now we'll use the fact that the ILC is really a 500 GeV machine and talk about going to 500 GeV. So at 500 GeV, this process turns on, which is WW fusion to Higgs. Now we have direct access to the WW coupling, both in production and decay, and we're in a much better situation to determine the total width. In particular, we have this reaction combined with a very accurate measurement of the branching ratio for Higgs to BB from 250 GeV. I should have said also here, you use WW in the final state and the branching ratio to WW. Putting everything together, you get directly 6% accuracy on the total width. That's 3% now in couplings. And if you do a global fit, using all of your data, that increases to something closer to the 1% level. So this program now brings you essentially to the percent level across the board in terms of Higgs couplings. You get another large slew of Higgs bosons, allowing improvements in the branching ratio measurements. The BCG separation is easier at higher energy. That's also an advantage. 500 GeV is not quite high enough to get large statistics on the TT-bar coupling, but at least you're in the game. And interestingly, those bound state effects that make the TT-bar threshold very sharp near 350 GeV also help you out by doubling the cross-section at 500 GeV. So here's the analogous table and the expected relative error on these measurements, and later we'll stuff them all into a global fit. Okay, finally, if you could go up to 1,000 GeV, actually most of the things on this list require only going up to about 700 or 800. Further improvement in the Higgs statistics because the W fusion cross-section continues to rise at high energy, and also the luminosity continues to rise. It's easier to make higher luminosity. You open up the TT-bar Higgs, and there's a coupling measurement of order 5%. I'll show you some details of that in a moment. You can begin the study, the serious study of the Higgs self-coupling with these two reactions. Right now, the people who are working on this with full simulation are claiming an accuracy of 24%. We'll see where that ends up in the next year, but that's a number you can put in your head. And you get some statistics on Higgs to mu plus mu minus, a coupling measurement of about 20%. It's not obvious that LHC couldn't do better on that measurement. Although at LHC, this process is about 5 orders of magnitude below the relevant background. But still, it's a very narrow peak. So we'll see what they can do. Okay. Last week, at the thing I attended in Japan, there were some new results on the TT-bar H. And I just wanted to show you a couple slides from that. So this is from the, presentation of the SID group to the ILC Program Advisory Committee. So this is roughly the situation. TT-bar is up here. There are a couple orders of magnitude discrepancy. This thing is the one femtobarn level. The TT glue, the glue is only radiated from the final state, fortunately, in E plus E minus. So it's a better situation than at LHC is down here. Higgs radiated from the Z is way down here. It's really not important. Except as a detail in this analysis. The cross-section you're talking about is a couple femtobarns, and you have 1,000 inverse femtobarns of data. Here's a fully simulated 8-jet signal event in the SID detector. The color coding actually means something. These detectors have so-called particle flow calorimetry, which gives roughly 3% accuracy in jet energy measurements in the energy range that we're talking about here. And so one can actually try to cluster these signals and separate the 8 jets and analyze them. Here's the final boosted decision tree output for various, the signal processes in blue, and the various background processes you see are significant here. The TT bar is multiplied by 1 over 100, so even though it's a log scale, that's an interesting contributor. In any event, the output of this analysis, done by Roloff and Jan Struba for SID, is that from the 6-jet plus lepton, one could get an estimate of the Higgs top coupling at the 7% level. From the 8-jet events, an independent measurement at the 6% level, combining them, you get to 4.5%. This is splitting half and half the polarization. So this is the thing I said before. If you did this with all left-handed polarization, you do somewhat better. Okay. In any case, this is a full simulation study with the SID detector, which justifies at least one of the numbers that I gave you earlier. And here's, again, some table of numbers that will go into a global fit. Yes? I'm sorry? Oh, we talked about that already at 250.
That's correct.
Oh. Well, you can only do the invisible decay when you can tag the Higgs decays with something else. So if it's dominantly WW fusion with only neutrinos in the final state, it becomes more difficult. So ZZ fusion I showed you is down by an order of magnitude in the cross-section. So it contributes something, but it's not really the way you want to do it. However, as I said, you get below a percent accuracy already at 250. So you, if that were an issue, you would run longer at 250. So for the purpose of this, it stays at what you got at 250. But, you know, if there were some reason, you could run longer at 250. If you found some dark sector products in the decays, you might just want to stay there and explore that more. And so I tried to put all these tables together, and this is what I came up with. So this is a kind of a single view of the ILC program through these stages. And so what you see here, this is now a global fit, which has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 parameters. And then what you do is that you add data from the various stages of the program. So the purple is what I showed you before for LHC, which is at least comparable to what other people are saying about the ultimate LHC capability. The blue is what happens if you just do the 250 GeV program. So please notice that the Z coupling is really pinned down at the percent level already, because that comes from the total cross-section measurement. But the W has this uncertainty that comes from the overall uncertainty in the top width from the global fit. To get rid of that uncertainty, you go to 500, and then you see that now collapses to the 1% level. And then this is the error that you kind of add in quadrature to all the other measurements. You can also see that some of the modes, for example, gamma-gamma especially, are highly statistics limited in the 250 GeV program. So this is much better at 1 TeV, but that's mainly the effect of statistics. For top, the improvement from here to here is coming completely from the global fit. There's no new information on top specifically in the blue curves, but in the red and rose, there is improvement. And actually, I used a somewhat weaker number than the one I just showed you at the time that I did this analysis. And invisible, I should just say, that's the square root of the invisible branching ratio. So if you square it, you get to the to about the half percent level in the global fit.
And you didn't plot the Higgs self-coupling.
The Higgs self-coupling is very large. You know, it's basically the whole plot on this scale. OK, I'm sorry. That's a genuinely hard measurement, also at LHC, as you know. Okay. Well, I also didn't want you to forget the qualitative differences between electron-positron and hadron collider experimentation. In PP, the Higgs is 10 to the minus 9 of the total cross-section. in E plus E minus, Higgs production is 1% of the total cross-section. And the other 99%, it's too jet-like, or it's things that look like W's. It looks very different from Higgs. And so here, you can pick out Higgs events by eye. Here, forget it. So here's a set of slides from this recent CMS analysis of the Higgs to tau. The Higgs to tau, it's very visible here. It's this little white box that you see here. Everything in color is a background. The orange, as I'm sure you've discussed already, is the zeta tau tau, which is extremely straightforward to model in CMS, and it's probably extremely well understood. The red is the reflection from W plus jets, and where, because both the W and the jets can fake taus, that's much harder to model. The idea of LHC experimentation is you have so much statistics that you can fit bins where the Higgs effect is supposed to be small. Using the overwhelming statistics, you then carry that fit up to these bins where the Higgs effect is supposed to be large, and you can determine it. And if you give yourself enormous statistics, you can determine it extremely well. On the other hand, it's a totally different story to pick out events that look like this by eye and say, I've observed Higgs to tau tau. Now, that's what I told the ILC program committee. But really, at a Hadron Collider, you can perfectly well, with a sufficiently cleaned up event display, find events that look like that just as easily at the LHC as at the ILC. The problem with the ILC is that the odds are 20 to 1 that it's background. LHC. The odds are 20 to 1 that it's background. Okay. So that's what I wanted to tell you about the ILC. So now we have to change gears a little and talk about what is the status of the ILC. So last week, the technical design report for the ILC was reviewed by the Program Advisory Committee. And so I just want to give you a few snapshots of what's in this technical design report to give you some idea of the level of seriousness with which the ILC R&D program has been carried out. And now, I think, in the opinion of both the internal members and the PAC, completed. The design is not site-specific, but it does address the major technical issues in the design, and all of the important components are prototyped. And so let's just look at a few of the important results. First of all, here's the final machine layout. Those of you who've been following this for some time will note that this has really changed a lot. Originally, there was some huge damping ring that ran around here. This is now still a very large machine, a couple kilometers, but a small fraction of the total 31-kilometer footprint of the machine. There's a single interaction region, and it's considered for the moment that two detectors will share the luminosity in a push-pull fashion. The beam gymnastics, some of it is a little complicated. This is a 10-kilometer long transport line on each side, which has to maintain an exquisite emittance in the beam. Actually, there's a model for that working in the ATF accelerator test facility at KEK. The electrons at this point produce positrons. If you produce positrons in an appropriate helical undulator, you can produce them polarized. That's an effect that I showed you was used here. And then you can maintain that polarization in the damping process. Here's a big table of beam parameters. Probably the thing of most interest to this group is the luminosity. So the nominal luminosity is 0.75 times 10 to the 34 at 250, 1 at 350, 1.8 at 500. That's actually a little better, if you like, than this proportional to energy scaling. The luminosity, I should point out, is not at an extremum in this plot. It's at a point in the center of a broad tune space. And the authors of this plot are very explicit that there are strategies for another factor of two that are kept in reserve. So if you decrease some tolerances or increase the power, there are strategies to get luminosities higher than this table, or maybe to make up for some slack if you don't quite meet the parameters that are given in this table. And please note both E plus and E minus polarization of 80% in the electron beam and 30% in the positron beam.
I mean,
there's a crossing angle, if that's what you mean.
No, not crossing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the beam is a ribbon. Numbers are probably on here. The horizontal beam size at the IP, let's take 250, is 700 nanometers. It should say vertical beam size is 8 nanometers. That's right. And that's to mitigate the beam strong. Okay. So let's go back to this blow up of the previous picture, which shows the connections between the damping ring, the positron production, and the accelerator. So the technical design report includes things like a three-dimensional CAD model of the magnets that actually implement this design. You see here the path to the damping ring. Here's the interaction point. This thing is a shield that basically takes the muons that comes from upstream and deflects them so they don't go into the interaction region. All of those things are considered. And this is the beam dump for the positrons, I think. And that all has to be engineered in. So well, we get to sit doing calculations and thinking about weird particles. Someone actually has to do this analysis, and it's been done. Okay. The main LINAC is composed of these niobium 9-cell cavities. The issue is to achieve, first of all, a high yield of cavities meeting the ILC spec, which is 31.5 MeV per meter, and to have industrial vendors in three regions that can do that. And so there was some experience in Germany because DAISY got started on this before other people. So there was some discussion at the meeting that blue is the greater than 28 MeV per meter yield, and red is the greater than 35 MeV per meter yield. The blue started out up here because there were three cavities that came from vendors working with DAISY. So then the rest of the world had to catch up, and as you see, the rest of the world now has caught up. So this is the 2010 to 2012 period. Many of the new cavities are actually achieving very high gradients. So the average gradient in this last column is actually 37.1 MeV per meter. So this directly impacts cost. You basically give your vendor a set of procedures that they follow, and you have to be willing to accept and pay for anything that comes back. So the more of them that meet the spec, the better you're doing. And I think they're doing now better than they expected originally.
Yes.
Right. You can go higher than 500 already.
What does that get you to?
It's 600 or something like that.
So how is it envisioned to? So when? Well, two questions. When they start at 250.
Yes.
What are they doing? Are they having fewer magnets or?
Fewer cavities.
And how do they imagine eventually going above 500?
Well, this was actually discussed at the meeting. So there's a kind of vanilla plan where you just buy more of the same thing. But because that decision's in the future, you can hope that people are doing better, and then it won't be as expensive to get the next 500 because you have higher gradient cavities. And so we'll just see what the experience is in 2020 for people who've now already produced thousands of these cavities for the first stage. Jeff, you had a question. Okay. This is a very interesting thing. This is a picture of something called the S1 global test. So this is a cryo module, which contained, I think, two cavities from industrial vendors in each of three regions. And it's supposed to be plug compatible. So it's supposed to be that you can take these cavities from vendors all over the world, put them together, and get something that actually works and achieves the spec. I think this did not achieve 31 MeV per meter in every cavity, but it did work. It's in the high 20s the first time they tried it. So this is at least a demonstration that, this vision of the ILC, where you're buying high-tech products from three regions and putting them together into a global project, actually has some sense to it. One of the problems is the maintenance of ultra-low emission in the damping ring. There's an effect called electron cloud, by which positrons stir up electrons that then degrade their emittance. CSER has now been a test bed for this, and there's apparently a very interesting program that's been concluded there on the mitigation of electron cloud. Here is a fully instrumented wiggler, and here's just the data from that. So green is what happens if you just do what you normally do. The black and the gray are two different surface coatings, and which already provide, you see, about a factor of two when you get down to here. And then if you actively go and use electrodes to drive out the electrons, you can get down to this purple area, which really is quite sufficient for really those most critical segments of the ILC damping ring. Okay. Finally, the sites. I'm going to tell you a little later about the politics of this, but we'll talk about, in Japan, they're talking about mountainous sites. One up here called Kitakami, the city, Tokyo is here, Sendai is here. This is the region which was affected by the Tohoku earthquake. And so this is a mountainous site in that region. The nearest university is Tohoku University, which is in Sendai right here. Then on the other side of Japan, equally remote from Tokyo, there's another mountain site called Saga Province. The city of Fukuoka is here. Fukuoka has a new university. I don't know if any of you know Kawagoe, who used to be in Kobe. I think he's moved there. And in any case, these two sites are now competing for the Japanese site selection. We'll talk a little more about that. The fact that you're under mountains creates new difficulties, but some people would say opportunities. Barry Barish was involved in MACRO, which was in the Gran Sasso Tunnel. And he likes the idea that something under a mountain can have horizontal access through long roads that you tunnel horizontally. There's a new design for the tunnel in a mountainous site. You excavate one large semicircle, and then you put a radiation barrier in the middle. So the radiation engineering is such that the accelerator can be here, and people can work on the klystrons and replace components over on this side. Here is an engineered design for the interaction region in a mountainous site. So everything is horizontal. There are little hideaways to work on the detector. And there are, as I said, two detectors, which the vision is would operate in a push-pull fashion. OK. And so, well, I haven't read to you the whole TDR, but I hope I've convinced you that a huge amount of work has gone into the engineering of this project, and that in the opinion of the people who did that work and in the opinion of Lynn Evans, who's, I guess, the head of the PAC and also the new director of the Linear Collider Organization, this is ready for a proposal to construct. And so now we come to the final question, will Japan host the ILC? And so here, my answer is not going to be so clean, but we have to go through it in some stages. So first of all, what is the attitude of the Japanese high-energy physics community? So on the next slide, I'm going to give you the complete executive summary of something called the final report of the Subcommittee on Future Projects in High-Energy Physics. This is the Japanese version of the HEPAP subcommittee. It met actually last year and issued the original version of this report in Japanese on February 11th, 2012, yeah. And here's the conclusion. So it has all three of the things that you would expect. At the top, a very interesting statement. Should a new particle, such as the Higgs boson, with a mass below approximately 1 TeV be confirmed at LHC, Japan should take the leadership role in an early realization of an E plus E minus collider. In particular, if the particle is light, experiments at low collision energy should be started at the earliest possible time. The second item is neutrino physics. Should the neutrino mixing angle theta 1-3 be confirmed as large, Japan should aim to realize a large-scale neutrino detector through international cooperation. And then, of course, the B factory is also mentioned. It is important to complete and start the super KK B factory, including the detector as scheduled. So those are, if you like, the three main items in this page. This is the entire executive summary, so you guys can look at my slides and read this carefully offline. But I'd just like to point out a few things. First of all, the KK Super B factory is approved and it's actually under construction. So this is, it's happening. It is a program through, let's say, the mid-2020s in Japan. A future neutrino program, including Hyperkamiokande, a really large water Cherenkov detector, can be envisioned within the Japanese high energy physics budget. ILC, which is roughly 10 times more expensive, could only be done if new funding comes from outside the expected high energy physics budget. So in this statement, it's clear what the priorities are, but it's also clear that the Japanese high energy physics community is hedging their bets about what they want to do in the future. Okay. Now we have to ask, if you're going to get this large sum of money, is someone actually going to give it to you? And this, of course, is something that's very hard to understand. A politician will not promise sums of order $10 billion in advance of negotiations. And in Japan especially, the culture is very consensus-driven. So it's very hard to get any definite statement unless there's a very wide consensus that this is the right thing to say. But nevertheless, there are positive signs, and let's go through them. So first of all, I ought to show this. This is from Akira Yamamoto, who's a director of accelerators at KEK. This is a roadmap to realize ILC. The construction time is 10 years, so you see some possible dates here. You would need to construct, if you start in 2016, you could complete by 2025. You need to have the project budget approval in 2014. That's obviously very ambitious. The proposal is to keep the full energy construction, however, with staging, so that stage one would be the Higgs factory at 250, stage two would be the full energy, and stage three, which is not budgeted in this proposal, is a full extension up to 1 TeV. The budget sharing, this is an interesting statement, the basic assumption is 50% by the host country, but it corresponds to 70% for the stage one construction. So at least the Japanese high energy physics community say Japan may put some money up front to get this started, requiring a relatively low level of buy-in by whatever the partners might be, US, Europe, China, we hope, although if Japan and China go to war, I don't know what happens. Sorry? The cost of the 250 is 70% of the whole project cost. And the project cost of the ILC, I think, has not really changed very much since the last estimate you saw. Now, we talk about some groups that are lobbying for the ILC. So a very prominent one is something called the Advanced Accelerator Association. Here's their website. You can look it up. The honorary chairman is Koshiba, the Nobel Prize winner. There are 91 corporate and 38 university members. The corporate members include more or less everyone you might hope to be there: Canon, Hitachi, IBM Japan, Mitsubishi, NEC, etc. Here are some statements from their report. Japan has accomplished and contributed to important scientific and technological results in the past, yet we have not recognized enough to truly call ourselves leaders in science and technology in the world. The AAA has designated the ILC as its core project. The ILC will bring a great expectation to the future of Japan and Asia. So the idea here is industrialists, again, coming into play, trying to support a project that they feel, in what's written here, would be a technological boost to Japan. There's another interesting group called the Japan Policy Council. The chair is a fellow named Masuda, who is a University of Tokyo professor who is involved in the creation of the Tsukuba Science City. And his vision is a new Tsukuba in some region further from Tokyo that would foster economic development in a region that's going down and being depopulated in the current economic evolution of Japan. So there's something, a document which you'll find on the website, Creation of Global Cities by Hosting the International Linear Collider. Japan should revitalize its provincial cities to revitalize Japan itself. We should explore domestic globalization, taking advantage of the opportunity of Japan's bid to host the International Linear Collider project. And here's an illustration that they give. So this is, if you like, a new Tsukuba in the Iwate region with ILC. At least, I guess, the ILC control center, the mountains, are about a couple kilometers that way here.
But this is still with the ILC embedded in the mountain?
Yeah, this is with the ILC in the mountain and the university and physicists working here, and of course many other technological centers growing up around it as they've grown up around Tsukuba. Of course, the word has gotten out. The provincial governors love it. There are expressions of support from the governors of Iwate and Saga provinces, which are in the regions of those sites that I showed you. ILC appears in the press. Here's a kind of random one. Katsube-san and Fuse-san, the mayors of cities in the Iwate region, discuss their cooperative partnership concerning a wide number of issues, including, as you see, ILC. So, okay. Somewhere on the road to Morioka, you'll see a sign that looks like this. But now let's get a little more serious. These next few slides are taken by a talk from Satoshi Yamashita at the Korean Linear Collider meeting, the Asian region Linear Collider meeting, which took place in April. So there's something called a Federation of Diet Members for Promoting ILC. This was founded, as you see, in 2006 by members of the LDP, but it was expanded in 2008 to include basically everyone in the government except these new right-wing parties. The Democratic Party, which then took power in 2008, the LDP, which, as you know, were the big winners in Sunday's election, the new Kumeito Party, which is another smaller liberal group, and so on. And, well, they're in favor of ILC. Here it says somewhere in Asia, but here it says Japan as the host. In December 2011, the AAA, which I told you about before, the industrialists, and the Federation of Diet Members held a symposium, and the then Prime Minister, Yoshihiko Noda, was a speaker. So here's Suzuki, the director of KEK. You probably recognize Sachiko Miya. This is Yamashita over here. This is Noda. And most of the other people in this picture are prominent politicians in Japan. So, and again, no promises of money, but the fact that these people showed up already tells you something. And then another important development. After the tsunami, the Iwate province officially proposed the ILC project at Kitakami as part of the recovery from the disaster. And so this is now on the menu in terms of the economic revitalization of the Tohoku region after the earthquake disaster of last year. And as you'll see, there's some political steps that have happened from that, including, most importantly, a budget to do investigation of the geology in preparation for site selection. So all this process is going on. And last slide from Yamashita. Here's a diagram that he showed of the activities. So KEK, the university in each of these two regions, the cities which are involved, and the prefectures, So everyone is talking to everyone else about the possibility of site selection. It's a situation really very similar to what was going on with the SSC in the US in the mid-1980s, before Reagan's decision, but really in the stages leading up to Reagan's decision to fund the SSC. And then one more thing. The ILC appears in the LDP election manifesto. So this is the fellow who is the new prime minister of Japan, Mr. Abe. Here's what it says. This is item 32, but you didn't expect it to be item one, did you? A very urgent issue is for leaders of the country to take the lead in science and technology innovation and aim for new growth in order to develop the future society and economy. That's what it says in this first paragraph. And down here, after talking about, you know, medical and environmental, and make Japan a leading role in the formation of an international scientific innovation base that includes, for example, the plan for the ILC. And here you see ILC International Linear Collider. Okay, so if people ask you whether ILC has political traction in Japan, you should say yes. Although one thing that I should point out is that all of these ideas are based on the global understanding that the ILC is needed to do what is really one of the very top programs in physics in the world. And Yamashita actually concluded his talk with this statement, clear and timely voice of the world high energy physics community and the global proposal as solid as possible are the most essential to realize ILC in the near future. So this is a very important statement. It's not about money. Right now, it's about whether physicists think this is, maybe with LHC, the number one high energy physics project in the world. And you guys should go and think about that and decide what you think about it. And if you think about it, you can convince your colleagues. And if we can get a statement purely from the physics side that this is incredibly important, that will help this go forward in Japan. And if not, not. So it's for you guys to make this work. Okay, so here's what I said. First of all, we need to envision an ultimate program of Higgs measurements that will supply all sizable Higgs couplings in a model-independent way to percent accuracy. I've shown you that the ILC will supply that program, with the exception, of course, of the Higgs self-coupling, which no one really knows how to do this well. But in any case, no other proposed facility fills this requirement. The ILC technical design is well advanced. The ILC is ready for a construction proposal. There are many positive signs that Japan will bid to host the ILC. We can have this ultimate Higgs program, but the world high energy physics community has to say that if they build it, we'll go there. And we'll see what they say, but I hope so. Thank you very much. Yes? I didn't. The costing of the ILC is very strange. The GDE quotes a materials cost, which is something like $7 billion. So what I like to say is that the ILC costs $7 billion in Japan, sorry, in Europe, $14 billion in Japan, and $22 billion in the US, which are the numbers you would derive from that estimate based on the way, different way that different regions do their costing. So if you just put a cost out there, you have to qualify it in all these ways. Now, the money, of course, is spent in each region. So if, as the plan would be, you have this long accelerator made of these superconducting nine-cell cavities, roughly a third, the plan would be produced in each region. And that money would go directly from the governments in that region, or maybe in Europe from the CERN Council, to the industrial vendors in that region. And that makes costing really hard, because you have to then, I mean, you don't do currency conversion. You agree on equivalent value, and then it costs a different amount to produce in every region. but the numbers at least give you some guidance. Jeff.
The second one is, does Slack itself have a position on the ILC?
I think the most risky part has always been considered to be the likelihood that these cavities would come out of industry and they wouldn't meet the specs. And I think now people are feeling much more confident that that part of it is under control. Admittance control is less of an issue. As I say, electron beam is much better understood. People consider that a major risk. I'm not sure what's bubbled to the top now. Please excuse me. I think most of the things that I covered are supposed to be the dominant risks and what has been done to mitigate them, so you can go down that list. The damage lifetimes are very small. That's an issue for the warm cavities, but I think it was never an issue for these cavities. Although maybe if you go to the hairy edge, it will become more of an issue. As for Slack's position, it's very confusing. I mean, Slack is, we're now a relatively small laboratory in the world of high energy physics. We now have a big commitment to LHC. So right now we're positioning ourselves for a role in the Atlas upgrade. And how all these things fit together, it's not clear. The people at KEK have definitely sat down with the people at Slack and discussed what Slack could contribute to the project as you know, specific elements that could be done in kind at our lab, and there's a list of them. We're not big in superconductivity. So these are other parts of the project, like the final focus, the beam delivery region, et cetera. But you know, it depends on, you know, does DOE give us the money to do that or not? And are we going to hire new people to expand our existing effort, which we would have to do? And I hope those things will happen, but I really have no idea. You know, right now, the U.S. has, you know, we're down to about the minimal capacity in high energy physics to do anything, as you well know. And so we have to build up new capability, and how we're going to do that is still a mystery. We have to convince the DOE that we have really important things to do, convince Congress. I think this can play a role in that. We'll see. Yes. I should ask you that question. Maybe I'll ask Andy that question. I think for Higgs to mu plus mu minus, it's probably a race. That seems to be something very well adapted to do with LHC and very high statistics. The main problem is how far deeply you're buried in the background. The others, I think there are always obvious advantages to do it mu plus mu minus. You're going to get several thousand inverse femtobarns. Yes?
Well, it would be nice to see your projections that you have for the coupling to the parameters of the boson, and also how the 250 GeV ILC program compares to the 3.
Ah, yes. This is very subtle. And let me give you some of the difficulties. I'm not saying you're wrong, and in fact, I promised the LEP3 people I would make such a plot. but there, the different luminosities are quoted. So what's quoted for ILC is 0.75 times 10 to the 34. LEP3 quotes 1 times 10 to the 34. The ILC number, as I said, is it's something that's come out of an engineering design. It's been very carefully vetted. The 10 to the 34 is more or less the best Frank Zimmerman can do. So those are not comparable numbers. The LEP3 claims to run for 5 years. What I showed you for ILC was 3 years. So those things have to be put on the same footing. LEP3 has two detectors. And so if it's done by without moving Atlas and CMS, you have two detectors. I think the proponents claim you could have four detectors. Of course, you would have to build two more detectors. Someone said maybe Delphi's still there. Maybe we can wheel it in. OK, so you have to decide on your attitude toward all these issues to make a direct comparison. I think in general, I think the general conclusion will be that many of these things really are statistics limited. And you get a factor of the square root of 2, roughly all other things being equal, from having more detectors. And that's an advantage for LEP3. On the other hand, this business of the normalization of the Higgs width, which eventually comes into couplings, that's something that you can't get rid of except by running really much longer or going to higher energy. And so LEP3 can't go to higher energy. It's stuck at 250 GeV. So you have to say that 3 or 4% as an ultimate reach is that's perfectly fine, and we don't have to do better than that, which I think is a false statement. So we'll see. As I said, I promised that on January 10th, I'm going to give a talk about this at the next LEP3 meeting. So we'll see what I'm thinking then.
One of the reasons I ask that is because you often hear some of our colleagues say, well, we can't do anything until we have a couple of years of LEP, LHC and 14 TeV behind us, so we don't have to think about the future.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's just a statement I don't understand, because we have the Higgs boson, we know what we need to do, and, okay, I already said that. But, so, whenever someone says that, you should just ask them this question. But in Japan, but no, wait a minute. But now I'm going to answer the question. So one of the motivations. Yes? Okay. But some people say that in a more educated way than others. But at the SNOMAS meeting at Fermilab, Pierre Adoni just got up and said this. And it really didn't seem to make much sense. So I'm sorry, I'm just reacting to that. But for Japan, many of these things that I had on the slides in that chapter are things that will continue to be true in the future. But one of them is not, which is the question of the recovery from the earthquake. I mean, those funds are being allocated now. And so, you know, we might have a year or two, but we can't wait 5 years to reallocate those funds, which will already have been spent. And that's an important part of the story. So there is some urgency. Well, yeah, because those regions need recovery. That's right. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that there are funds allocated for this economic recovery, which will be allocated in the next couple of years. And then after that, you might still have an opportunity to do a big high-energy physics project for other reasons. But there is something that makes this timely. Oh, because it's Japan. Because if you allocate tens of billions of dollars, you can only give half of it to one region of the country, and the other half has to be spread around the rest of the country. Doesn't that make sense? In a society that works by consensus? No, because in general, the economy of Japan is moribund. So if you're going to stimulate one region, you should distribute money to stimulate the other regions that need it. I'm sorry, this is not something I made up. This is something people have told me. So. Right. But on the other hand, Japan has tried austerity for a long time, and it hasn't worked, so maybe stimulus is a good thing.
Any other questions out there?
Yes. The spallation neutron source is based on superconducting RF. It's working. It works. So that's one large application of superconducting RF. Of course, in Germany, the XFEL, the major DAISY project of the current generation, is based on superconducting RF. That's a somewhat lower gradient. Of course, the Jefferson Lab accelerator is superconducting RF. The spallation neutron source is superconducting RF. Project X at Fermilab is superconducting RF. And then this big X-ray laser at DAISY is superconducting RF. And it's thought that, you know, within accelerator applications, there are many more applications of this coming. So one of the reasons put forward when people made the original warm versus cold decision was that this was a key technology, which if one invested in it, it would bring returns.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, well, it's time for the call again.